Gang, if you're sitting around with your friends right now trying to figure out how to play Back in the New York Groove by Ace Frehley on ukulele, I have an amazing app for you. Whether you are a professional musician or a beginner, Ultimate Guitar is the perfect app for you. For just $2.99, you get the chords and tabs for over a million songs on guitar, bass, or ukulele. You also get tools like a tuner, a metronome, a chord library, lessons, videos, and more. Go to ultimateguitar.com or download the app to your phone and start playing today. That's Ultimate Guitar. Let's get down.
And you may ask yourself, well, how did I get here?
It's time for How Did I Get Here? And now here is your host.
All right, hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host, and welcome to the show. I hope you guys all had a fantastic weekend. I had a good weekend. I went out and played some shows with Skyrocket. We played a lady's birthday party on Saturday in Houston on the roof of this place. It was pretty interesting because they rented the place up until 10 o'clock for the party. And once it turned 10 o'clock, it turned into the place it is, which is a rooftop hookah bar. So as we were finishing the set, people were bringing in like tons of hookahs. I mean, tons of hookahs. I can't even like, you've never seen like three guys bringing in like four hookahs at a time, like 17 times. It was amazing. There were hookahs on every table. It was a lady's 60th birthday. And as I was loading out, you could see the people kind of hanging out, mingling. And as the crowds were kind of shifting, there were still some leftover 60-year-olds hanging out, smoking on hookahs. It was totally weird. Anyway, then Sunday, I went and hung out with my aunt and my grandma, my cousin Megan, had a good time, had a nice nap over there at my grandma's house. And then I headed down to Clear Lake, play another show with Skyrocket. It was a holiday Christmas party for a car dealership down there in Clear Lake. It was interesting. It was good. We had this thing where we finished the set, and then they wanted to give away some prizes. And then they wanted us to get back up and play like three songs, which is kind of weird because you play the whole show and then like they give away a bunch of prizes for like a half an hour, like a whole half an hour, like the vibe is gone. So when we went back on stage, we went back like insane. We went back, there was like an absurd slant to our performance. There was like a 5-minute opening to a song where Trish read like these cue cards that all these people wrote thank yous to their bosses and stuff. And she collected them all from the people and just started reading them on stage. It was insane. Totally insane. Anyway, it was a great weekend. I hope you had a great weekend. I've got an amazing show for you guys today. Now, you might remember a few months ago, like back in July and August, if you listened to the show, I was rehearsing with Scrappy Judd Newcomb and Bruce Hughes and John Chipman for this Dudley and Bob 25th anniversary show. I was in the house band and so were they. And we were doing these rehearsals leading up to the show and just kind of hanging out a lot. And those guys were always talking about this guy, Johnny Nicholas, that they play with. And so they kind of hit me to him. I didn't listen to him then, but he got in my consciousness. And then like last week, my friend Jamie Harris hit me up and she's like, hey, this guy, Johnny Nicholas, is re-releasing this record that's like 40 years old. And I'm like, oh, really? She's like, yeah, man, it's out of print. He's re-releasing it. And it's a really exciting thing, and they're doing a release show. I was like, man, let's get him in here. So he's releasing this record. And let me tell you about Johnny Nicholas. Hold on. Just a quick second. So Johnny Nicholas is this guy. Turns out he's this guy that comes from Rhode Island. He was part of the Ann Arbor, Michigan scene in the early 70s, like the blues rock scene and the rock scene that was going up there with MC5 and Iggy and the Stooges and stuff. And then he headed out to San Francisco, where he was part of the scene out there with the guys from Asleep at the Wheel, the guys from Commander Cody and stuff. And I think I might have it backwards. He might have gone to San Francisco first, then Ann Arbor. Then he heads down to Austin and comes in and is part of the Armadillo scene that was going on in the late 70s. Gets signed, makes this record, Too Many Bad Habits, Johnny Nicholas and Friends, and puts it out in 1977, and then decides to join Asleep at the Wheel. So his record label just made a finite amount of copies, and then it just kind of went away. It was out of print for a lot of years. Johnny finished up his stint with Asleep at the Wheel, moved out to to Fredericksburg, opened the Hilltop Cafe, the legendary Hilltop Cafe. He laid low for a little while, doing a little gig here, a little gig there, then started making records again in the late 80s. Anyway, he's been making records ever since, and I went through all of his stuff. It's absolutely amazing. And his last record, Fresh Air, which came out last year, was down one of Downbeat's best of 2017 albums. It was produced by my pal Bruce Hughes, and his story is absolutely amazing, and we have a fantastic conversation about it. So the reason why he's coming in is after 40 years, that first record that he made that went out of print, Too Many Bad Habits, has been repackaged, remastered. A lot of tracks have been added to it. And there's a reissue. The reissue has been produced by Bruce Hughes. It was mixed and engineered by Mark Chafin and Matt Parmenter, my dear friend over at the Ice Cream Factory. Matt Parmenter remastered it. And the original recording was done by a lot of different dudes, including Joe Gracie. And this package is absolutely gorgeous. So my friend Jamie told me, yeah, he's putting out this record again. It's coming out. It's got this beautiful package. I got a copy of it. It's got like a 20-page book inside with the whole story about it from Ed Ward. Lots of rock people talking about Johnny's scene and what Johnny means to the blues. I learned a lot. I learned a lot from Johnny. This record's absolutely gorgeous. It features blues icons Sonny Shines, Big Walter, and the legendary Boogie Woogie Red, along with Ray Benson, a lot of members of Asleep at the Wheel that were around there in the late 70s. This record comes out this Thursday, December 7th, and they are celebrating with an in-store at Waterloo Records at 5 p.m. on Thursday, December 7th, and also that night, Thursday, December 7th, Antones at 9:30 p.m. Johnny Nicholas and I have an amazing conversation. It was great getting to talk to him. Unfortunately, it was too short. He had to go somewhere. He had to go meet someone. And so we only got to talk. We didn't get to talk for the five-hour thing that I was hoping we were going to get to talk for. This album, Too Many Bad Habits, is absolutely gorgeous. Go to johnnynicholasblues.com. Find out how to get tickets to Antones. Remember that the Waterloo in-store, if you live in Austin, get out there at 5 p.m. That's free. They usually have free beer. Pick up a copy of this. I think it's also coming out on vinyl. It's now a double disc. They added a whole bunch more music to it. JohnnyNicholasBlues.com, all right? Enjoy my conversation as I sit down face-to-face, or as I should say, Johnny to Johnny, with Johnny Nicholas. Great conversation. Enjoy it. Let's get down.
Yeah, we're playing over at the White Horse tonight, me and Scrappy and Chipman and Danny Levin and Kevin Smith and Floyd Domino, my little side project.
That's the Tiffany Six?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we have a lot of fun with it, man.
That's a bunch of great musicians, man.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. How long have you known Danny Levin?
Oh, shit, I was in the Wheel with Danny. I knew Danny. Well, I met Danny when I joined the Wheel. Because he had just joined, he knew those guys from way back, but he wasn't out in Oakland when I met the Wheel through with Cody, went before they moved to Texas.
Commander Cody?
Yeah.
So you were part of that original Armadillo influx. I was just emailing with a publicist about talking to Eddie. And
I just got off the phone with Eddie, man.
Oh, really?
We were driving
That's
up here,
so funny.
And I talked to him for quite a while. And then I've been on the phone the rest of the time with Bill Campbell, and he and I are, he's starting to practice again on the guitar, and he's wanting to play. I'm going to put together a little side project with him after the first of the year. So me and Campbell go way back, too.
Wow.
You know who Bill is?
No.
Bill Campbell?
No. Oh, I mean, maybe, man. I do.
Well, he was the guy, he was playing, he's an Austin guy, and he was playing, doing all this shit and playing with all the guys on the East Side in the 60s and late and into the 70s when Antone, before Antone and all of them even moved up here. And He's got, that's a guy, boy, if you could.
Wrangle that guy in here?
Oh, he's a character, man. He's a badass guitar player. He used to, when Antones was on 6th Street, man, he was there a lot. But his guitar battles with Albert Collins are fucking legendary. And Stevie, rest his soul, or Jimmy both would have told you, he was the guy, when they came down from Dallas, that's who they went to see.
Wow.
Yeah, he was a bad son of a bitch, man. He played with Delbert for a lot of years. He's a great player, man. He's the real deal.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's cool.
So let's talk about what made this too many bad habits. Like, why are you re-releasing it? What was the not in a weird way, but what was the impetus that made you want to re-release this, or who wanted to?
Well, I mean, the obvious question is, if it's already been out, why would you re-release it? But in this case, this album was released in 77, and less than a year later, when I joined Asleep at the Wheel, the record company called me up, because we had already sold the first pressing of vinyl, and they called up and they said, hey, man, you're not going to be touring under your own name anymore, so we're cutting the record out. We're not going to reprint it. And I said, really? But at the time, man, I was riding high. I didn't care. And I was with the Wheel. We were recording for Capitol and all that stuff. And so I didn't think much of it. And then, I had also brought Big Walter Horton to them, and because he and I were tight. And I got, he signed a one record deal with them, a really good album that he did on Blind Pig with my band backing him up, which at that time actually included a couple of people that have become Austin staples, like Sarah Brown and Kaz. I brought them to Texas the first time they ever been to Texas. I brought them down.
Where was Sarah? Sarah's from Rhode Island?
No, she was from Ann Arbor.
Oh, okay.
But then she came out to Boston when I was all over the place. I just went wherever there was a hot music scene, and where I could make money and be around stuff that I liked. And so that Ann Arbor was one of those stops, and that's where I met. That was a big, a really hot scene in the early 70s. So that's where how I met Sarah, and then she played with me and Franny Christina and Steve Nardella. We had a thing called the Boogie Brothers.
Yeah.
And John Sinclair. Do you know who John is?
No,
but I
know.
He was the guy, the Rainbow People's Party and the White
Panthers. Oh, you mean like John Sinclair? Oh, yeah, because you were up there in Michigan. Yeah, okay. And Fran was up there too?
Yeah, I brought Franny out there. He had been in Rhode Island with, we had a band for in 1970, me and Duke Robillard and Franny and Steve Nardella and Larry Slow Drag Peduzzi, who was the bass player, who had been the original bass player with Roomful. Then he came in with this thing we had called Black Cat, and we had a smoking band, man. Al Copley joined about halfway through, but it only lasted about a year. And then Duke was getting more interested in the horns. He was really into Buddy Johnson and Louis Jordan and all that. But, we dug the more traditional stuff. And so Steve and I, we had been out to the Ann Arbor Blues Festival and really dug the scene there. So we hitchhiked out there, started playing around there. And then I brought Franny out, and he joined us up there in Ann Arbor. And we opened a show for Cody at the Hill Auditorium, and he really dug us, and we dug him and all the crazy cats. And they said, man, you got to come out to the Bay Area. We'll get you some gigs. And, what the hell, So we had, Franny had a, he and Julie had a Volkswagen bus, and the starter didn't work on it, so we pushed that thing all the way across the country every time we had to start it, But we got out there and, met Cody. Cody and they had a place for us to stay at Lance Dickerson's house, and we rolled in there and we were doing our thing. And he said, hey, man, the Wheel's coming over. So who's the Wheel, Oh, man, you're going to dig these cats, Here come all these hippies with cowboy hats, and we were blues guys, but we dug it. I mean, we were hippies, too, in our own way. You know, they brought in drum instruments and stuff, and we jammed all night with all the guys from Cody and those guys, and we became friends right there. That was about 71, I'd say.
And all those guys were living out there?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. That's where the wheel started in right. West Virginia, but then they moved out to the Bay Area. They were there for 3 or 4 years, and we both knew about Austin. I had been through here on my way to see family in Houston and Lake Charles. And I was friends with Link Davis Jr., so I really liked to go down to Louisiana whenever I could. And Jimmy Vaughn had heard, they had broadcast, we performed at the 1972 Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festival. And it was called the Boogie Brothers, but John Sinclair billed us as without our permission, as the Boogie Brothers with Sister Sarah Brown, which, you know, it was his thing, you know, and it was cool.
What was he, just real quick, what was he like? Because I've John, read a lot about his lore and a lot of the stuff about the MC5 and all that stuff.
Well,
and
he was always real jolly around me, man. I mean, he always had a spleef, and, you know, he was, he was a fan of ours. He'd come to our shows, and he booked us. I played on every one of those, the Ann Arbor Blues and Jazz Festivals.
Who else was on that?
The one on in 72, yeah. Because they put out a double album on Atlantic, and we were on it, Boogie
awesome.
Brothers. But, yeah, Bonnie Raitt with Sippy Wallace, Bobby Blue Bland, Sun Ra, Howlin' Wolf, Muddy Waters, Hound Dog Taylor, I think Mississippi Fred McDowell, with Johnny Woods, the wildest looking cat I've ever seen, man. He had one bright blue eye and one brown eye, and both of them had the irises had circles around them. They were the weirdest looking eyes, and he stayed drunk all the time too. but he was a harmonica player from Mississippi. That album and that festival, that was my first recorded thing. But they also broadcast the whole thing live on radio, and it went all over the country. And so Jimmy was down here in Texas digging in blues, and he heard us, and he knew about us because he had heard the radio thing. So then we got connected, you know, around in that time. And then I'd go back out east. I wound up going back out there about 75. I kind of got stuck out there. So that's when I formed a band, and that's where I met Kaz and formed the Rhythm Rockers. But at that time, then Jimmy and them, when they made their first trip up there with Keith, and that was before Mike Buck was even in the band.
Wow.
You know,
who was playing drums then?
They had a guy, his name was Lester or something. I forgot, what was
his
name? Another
guy that's around now?
Little skinny black guy, man. He drove up there with them in the van. They drove for 3 days to get there, and then he got homesick and he missed his girlfriend, so he didn't even play a gig the next day. He got on a Greyhound bus and drove back and rode back to Texas.
Well, God bless him, man. This isn't for everyone, is it?
Yeah, and that's how Franny kind of got hooked up initially with the T-Birds. He did some stuff with them, and then they came back down here, and then Bucky joined the band. And then Franny and I were doing stuff together, and then he moved back up to Nova Scotia, Canada, and there's a great story there too, because he was up there and the T-Birds, when that whole thing happened, when their drummer left and went back to they wound up, they didn't have a drummer, and so I said, well, hey man, I know Franny's up in Canada, you know. So I went down to his mother's house, and I got the, they didn't have phones. There was no cell phones or anything. You know, man, I got the number. I knew his mom real well, and I'd grown up with him too, him and Duke both. And I got his number, and she said, well, you got to call this is the town. They're about 5 miles outside of this town. They were living out in the country, man, real primitive. And so I called the Canadian Mounted Police. It's the only way I knew to get to him. I said, hey, man, you got a gig in Windsor with this band, and you got to be there by such. And so anyhow, they were out there, and, you know, I don't know, you know, whatever they were doing, but they were pretty, when the Mounties showed up, they were really worried, but he was coming to give them a message to go. But anyhow, so I, you know, got them connected, and he did that little tour with them, and then they came back to Texas, and then he went back there to Canada. And then when I joined, when Ray called me, to, you know, and I was back and forth all over the place, but then Ray called me to join the band, and I
Sleep
came
the
down.
Wheel?
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah. And I came down, that was in late 77, early 78, somewhere in 78. And so I came down and joined up, and you know, they had a great drummer then named Chris York, from Fort Worth, but Chris was a straight up country drummer. I mean, and he was great for that. But Ray was wanting to do more jump blues and different stuff, and you know, more swing. And so anyhow, we hired we got Franny to come down and join the band. And so Franny was in the band when I was, Link Davis Jr., Tony Garnier, Lucky Oceans,
right?
Ray, Chris, Taco. You know, and Danny, and that's so in a roundabout way. Okay. Got back to Danny. That's how I met Danny. Yeah, yeah. So
that's unbelievable. So you had made this record before you moved down here.
Oh yeah,
the 2 minutes.
Yeah, during all those ramblings, and part of that's what happened. That's what you'll see, the liner notes by Ed Ward, and he tells the whole history of this thing.
Okay,
but you know, I would spend a few months in Texas. I'd go to Louisiana. I'd go to New Orleans. I'd go back up to Memphis. I'd go back to Chicago. Then I'd go to Ann Arbor. I had a place there, a little house there on the outside. I stayed there, you know. So. One of my trips in Texas, I was here, and Ray was living on a house on South 6th Street, which I later moved into, right off of kind of Annie and back over in that, by the railroad tracks there in South Austin. Uh-huh. And so, you know, I told him I was going to be doing a record. He said, well, man, let's record some stuff. So he got, do you remember who Joe Gracie was?
Of course, yeah. Yeah. I do a lot of work with Kimmy.
Oh.
And with Gabe, both.
Well,
of them. Yeah.
Joe was a dear friend and a great part of Austin music history, as you know.
Yeah.
Joe came over, set up his little two-track thing in the bedroom, and we set up in the living room, me and Lucky Oceans and Tony Garnier and Ray, and Bill Mabry was playing fiddle with them at the time. And we recorded some stuff on two-track with them, which came out on the my album. Plus, back in Ann Arbor, all during those years earlier, I had been playing with Johnny Shines and Walter, Big Walter, for quite a while. Did a lot of traveling with Walter. And I had, so we had made, you know, they were both on the original album on vinyl when it came out in 77. That's why it was called John Nicholas and Friends.
Okay.
And then another interesting thing is a guy that played drums. He was a kid then, but his name was Martin Gross. He has since become, he's a really well-known drummer and music guy up in the Detroit area. His band was Kid Rock's backup band for from before Kid Rock got famous up to a few years into, and then they parted ways at some point, but his name's Tino Gross, and he's a great cat, great drummer. So he was on it, you know, the guys I mentioned from Asleep at the Wheel, from the sessions that Joe Gracie recorded, and then also the stuff I did with Boogie Woogie Red, who's the guy that taught me how to play piano. He was a Detroit guy that had played with, I don't know, people don't know it, but Sonny Boy Williamson, number two, spent a lot of time in Detroit. He was real tight with a guy named Calvin Frazier, who was a great guitar player and who was Robert Johnson's cousin.
Right, yeah.
And Calvin Frazier and Sonny Boy and Boogie Woogie Red, they played in these joints around Detroit, and then also over to Cleveland because Robert Jr. had moved over there. So, you know, I got to know all those guys, not Sonny Boy, but and Red, and he became a mainstay. We brought him over to Ann Arbor, and he started playing at the Blind Pig, which was a club before it was a record label.
Okay.
And so, you know, I brought all these guys. I would bring people up from Chicago, and you know, we'd back everybody up, and it was kind of a thing, man. It was, you know, a great scene there in Ann Arbor. You could play I played seven nights a week. I mean,
wow.
And, you know, different places. They all were booking blues and root, what they call roots music now.
Yeah.
It was just a great scene. And so, you know, I had those guys, so it was natural when I did my album. I said, hey, come on, you know, they made some dough and re-recorded. Well, then they cut out the album, and I couldn't figure out why. And then years... then after I left the Wheel, I a few years later, I called him up. I said, hey man, can I have my stuff back? If you're not going to put
record?
It out.
Yeah.
You know, can I have my, you know, no. And they never would give me my stuff, and they gave Lucky Oceans his stuff. He had done an album for Blind Pig that I'm on. And a bunch of the Wheel people. It's called Lucky Steals the Wheel. Actually, it's a really good record.
Oh, I think I've seen that.
Yeah. But they gave him his stuff back, and he put it back out. So I could never get my album. And then I found out years and years later what they had done. See, I brought Walter to do an album for them, and he was very shy about record companies, and he had been
burned.
Yeah. And I was with him. I said, look, I'll. You know, make sure you get your money. You know, let's do. So he did signed a one record deal with them. And then my band, when I moved out to Boston, I told you I had the band with Kaz and Sarah,
uh-huh.
And I hired a kid named Ronnie Earl at the time.
Okay.
His name was Ronnie Horvath, but he later became
Ronnie Earl.
Earl. But I gave him his first gig.
Wow.
He was in the Rhythm Rockers. And I brought him and that band to Texas, and that's. Anyway, that's the other part. But while I had those guys, not Ronnie, when we backed up Walter, I used Ron Levy, who had been B.B. King's keyboard player, and Sarah, and I think Franny's on that, or either that or my other drummer. But it doesn't matter. We did this album with Walter, and there were four, maybe five additional tracks that we didn't use that were good tracks. And when Walter died, which was not long after, it was in the 80s, and he passed, and a few months later somebody called me up, said, hey, that other album of Big Walter with you guys on it is really great. I said, what other album? Well, they took the tracks that they had in the can, which they were supposed to give back to me or Walter. I never collected them. And then they took tracks off of this album, because Walter's on that album. He sings on a couple of things. He's playing harp. So they took stuff off of my album and filled out, had enough to make a second album, which was illegal. They didn't have an agreement with Walter. They didn't have an agreement with me. They didn't have licensing. They didn't have contracts. They didn't have nothing. So they were using my stuff over the years for different compilations and anthologies and anniversaries and all this stuff, but without permission. And so for years I tried to get my stuff back, and they'd never give it back to me. And then a few years ago, you know, they said, well, we'll sell it back to you, and this is that. And
yeah.
I finally talked, you know who Al Staheli
is? Yeah, I just saw his name in there.
Yeah,
great guy.
Great musician, too. But Al wrote them a letter, and when he saw what they were trying to get me to sign, they were going to give me my stuff, but they wanted me to pay them, and they wanted me to sign this, a bunch of new contracts. And I said, what do I need to sign new stuff for? Al looked at it. He said, well, what's going on here? He said, they want you to sign licensing agreements and releases. And turns out that they had sold the record company to the Orchard. You know what the Orchard is?
Yeah, it's a big entertainment company.
Holding company yeah. for small labels.
Oh, okay, okay.
It's like a distributor.
Now I do know, yeah.
Kind of deal. And so they were in the process of selling their thing, and they were supposed to have all their contracts in order. Well, obviously they didn't. The one we did for that record was a little piece of paper about that big, handwritten. Yeah. And so Al, they went from asking me for... They wanted from asking me for $2,500 or $3,000 to buy my stuff back from them to they sent me a large check. They paid Al's legal fees, and they sent me all my stuff, and I had it in 10 days.
That's good.
Yeah. So it was great. So here I had all this stuff. Well, then when Bill Johnson, I had Bill Johnson. I know you know Bill. Mm-hmm. He orchestrated the transfers of all the original tapes and multi-tracks. And lo and behold, I thought there was maybe one other cut that we hadn't used, but there were 12, 13, maybe more, all these other tracks, and they were good performances, man.
Wow.
And so all of that wound up, then it just expanded. And Bruce, I gave the stuff to Bruce, and he started listening. He said, man, this is some great stuff. You know, so I was just going to put out the album and have it in my catalog because it was my first album.
Sure.
Well, then it just kind of grew from there, man. And I realized there's a lot of historical significance in this connected with this album, with the people who are on it and that time in music history, all the things that were going on. So that's what the whole booklet is about. There's a 24-page book that's really a cool book with a lot of great posters and photos. And Ed Ward's wrote a lengthy kind of historical biography or liner notes, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
Really outlining the whole scene and the whole thing about this. So that's how that all came about.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing.
I mean, are you excited about it?
I'm absolutely excited about it. I mean, I justified putting it out, not just because of the significance of the music and the story, but also because aside from the first 1,000 or 2,000 LPs they pressed, that was it.
Yeah.
So it, for all intents and purposes, it never was available. And so that was part of the, you know, justification, but also just because it was such a, there was so much other good stuff there.
And so was it remixed? I'm sorry. No,
oh, yeah. Bruce remixed and mastered everything.
Cool.
Yeah. He did a great job, man. I mean, if you get a copy of the old LP and you listen to it compared to this.
Sure.
He did his magic. You know Bruce. He's amazing.
He is amazing. And you're doing you're doing release shows on Thursday, December 7th, day that will live in infamy,
at
Waterloo, an in-store at Waterloo Records at 5 p.m., and then at Antone's that night at 9:30.
That's correct.
So I was listening. Through the stories you were telling me, I was thinking about when I listened to part of your record from 1988. And then I listened to stuff all the way through, and then I ended up listening to Fresh Air a couple of times. It's really gorgeous, man.
It's a great album.
Yeah.
I'm very happy about it. And Bruce was a big part of the way it sounds. And we had been playing together since about 2010. Myself, Bruce, Scrappy, John Chipman. Cindy was, of course, in the band until she moved back to Woodstock. We had that thing and it's a good record. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really good. And what I saw in it was you come from a style of music that definitely has a lineage. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And people break out of it, and there's blues esque guys that go off and do other stuff. But when you're in the blues, you're in a tradition. Mm-hmm. You're not just a guy in a band. You're carrying a torch for something and kind of developing it, but it also has to stay within these certain parameters to keep it. It doesn't have to be a 1-4-5, but it has to stay within this language. And what I noticed is that you have been able, through your career, to grow as an artist within those parameters, bringing in other styles of music and reinventing the music that you make while still paying tribute to you do like Backdoor Man on that record and but you still there's still like a lot of new and fresh stuff that you're writing and you're coming up with. I find it really remarkable, and you are a really great artist and such an amazing songwriter.
Oh, thank you, man. And yeah. I'm really glad that came across to you, and it does to other people, because that's really who I see myself as. And I really, another reason that this album was important to me was because those guys, the early guys like Johnny, Robert Lockwood was one of my mentors, and Roosevelt Sykes was another one. They really encouraged me, even though they were traditional cats.
Right.
They really encouraged me to write and tell my own story and do what all the early blues cats did. I mean, most of them were writers and troubadours, and they were, whereas I would just say that sometimes even hesitate to call myself a blues guy nowadays because of what's happened to the genre. There's a whole lot of what is called blues now that I'm not saying it's not good, but it's not blues to me, even though it's 1-4-5. And so to me, I can't escape, I don't want to escape my roots or be, but knowing that my newer stuff still that you feel, you get that, it's still blues more at heart than a lot of what you hear that passes for blues nowadays that is 1-4-5 and stylistically more true to what you would think was a blues
thing. Like you mean like on Sixth Street?
Well, all over the country,
but like specifically, I can pinpoint it to that.
I call it the Blues Brothers factor. See, and I've had a lot of discussions about this with a lot of people, and I'm really, I think that was the beginning of the end for the blues. The real
I see exactly what you mean, yeah.
Beautiful, what was really deep and beautiful and so connected to American folk music and the heart and soul of the people that what blues connects to. That I understand what Belushi and them were trying to do, and they put a lot of money, they helped, and a lot of people, they say, oh well, yeah, but they did a lot of good and they brought awareness of the blues, and to me it's the wrong awareness of what they brought,
right.
You know, those guys and the way they portrayed themselves in those movies, it was really offensive to me. Because the cats that I knew, even though a lot of them, and I lived in the ghetto. I stayed on the west side of. I spent a lot of time on the south side of Chicago. I lived on the west side of Chicago. I spent a lot of time in Detroit, in Memphis, in East Oakland. So I was around a lot of cats and those people, even when they were very poor or in poor circumstances, they still dressed really nice. They strove to be. Belushi and their whole thing, I never knew anybody that dressed in shabby, dirty black suits and wore dark sunglasses and crappy little hats. That was foreign to me. I said, who are these guys? They're clowns.
Well, they literally, that was their job. They were clowns, yeah. Like professional clowns decided to start a blues band and make a movie.
You want to hear a great story about that?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, well, you know who Duke Robillard is, of course.
No, who is that? Why am I missing all this stuff? I feel
like
a jerk.
Duke Robillard, you know about Room Full of Blues?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, well, he was the guy that started Room Full of Blues. And in the 70s, they were super, super hot band. They were so great. And Duke played with, he was in Dylan's band for a while. He played with Robert Gordon. He's played with everybody.
He played with, on your record, right?
Duke, someone else.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
But I grew up with Duke. He's a very well-known blues guitarist and a great one. Duke's incredible. Jimmy will tell you, Stevie would have told you, anybody. And the whole Roomful thing was really hot in the 70s, and they were a hot item. And it was a club in the New York City called the Lone Star Cafe.
Uh-huh.
You remember that?
I just know the stories about it, yeah.
And so anyhow...
That was the place where like Cleve and all those guys were hanging
everybody.
Out.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so anyhow... Roomful was playing there, and the place was sold out, three nights, packed. And so they went up one night, they did their first set, and they got done with the first set, and Belushi and Aykroyd were there, and they came and got them, and they said, "Hey, you guys, we got some really great news for you. Come on, we got to come on outside. We got," and it, all the guys in the band, Duke and Piccolo and all of them, they were like, "Oh, well, let's make us have some nice, big, good gig for us or something, you know, playing a party or something, you know." They went outside, and they're standing out there, and they gets the whole band there, and then Belushi's like, "Okay." He said, "You guys are going to be so, so jazzed, man." He said, "We're starting up this thing, and it's going to be called the Blues Brothers, and we're going to make a movie, and we're going to go on the road, and you guys are going to be our backup band." And Duke looks at him, and he goes, "I'm not playing with you. You're not a musician." It's just dead serious. Just said, "I'm not playing with you."
Well, it's true.
You're not a, yeah, totally.
I mean, they were clones.
But how cool is that, man?
Super cool. Did you play there at the Lone Star Cafe?
Yeah,
yes, a lot.
I played there with my band, the Rhythm Rockers. I played there with The Wheel when I joined them. Yeah, it was a great place.
How long did, when did the Armadillo closed in like 81?
1980.
1980, actually.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, technically 81, because we were there till
the next day.
The next day. and that show, that New Year's Eve, it was Asleep at the Wheel when I was with The Wheel. Willie Nelson, I believe Maria Muldaur.
Yeah.
I think, was Cody there too?
I don't know.
It was a big show.
I just always cheer when I hear Maria Muldaur.
Yeah. Well, you know how they, you know, I can't remember everybody that was there. You know what they say about it.
If you can, if you were there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what made you move out to Fredericksburg?
My wife Brenda, okay. And I met her at Antone's on 6th Street in the 70s. Keith Ferguson introduced me. And she had been, went to school in Port Arthur with Clifford and David Elliott and Michael Amuni and a bunch of those cats that came up and started the mm-hmm. original club. And she helped them start it.
Wow.
She was a part of that. She was also a member of the Ritzettes, which was a burlesque dance troupe. They danced at the old Ritz Theater in the 70s when they had shows there. And then they had this dance group. They were really cool. It was the, you know, like a whole old school kind of review type thing, you know.
Yeah.
And that was going on. But Brenda, I met her at Antone's, and took me a few years, but I finally got her to marry me. And her grandfather lived out, even though she had gone to school and grew up in Port Arthur. She was always spending time in north of Fredericksburg out by Cherry Springs, where her grandfather had a place. And that's where she had mostly, had grown up, or where she really loved to be, you know. Mm. And so we went up there to be close to her grandparents, and we bought this little old honky-tonk beer joint gas station out in the middle of nowhere. Just little by little, it kind of evolved. You know, it was really funny, man, because when we first bought it in the early 80s, we'd be there. And, I mean, there wasn't even, this place was funky. The bathrooms, you had to walk outside, and there were a couple of bathrooms out back. And there were wood stoves and, you know, no plumbing inside. And, you know, it was funky, man. It was an old beer joint. And there'd be all these hardcore locals sitting around drinking beer and eating pickled eggs and, you know, talking German, a lot of them, you know, and here would, you know, the Asleep at the Wheel tour bus would pull up, or, you know, Willie Nelson the Fabulous Thunderbirds, and these characters would, it was something else, man. But
it's so cool, though, because you literally built a thing that just kept on turning. That's fucking almost 40 years ago, man. That's amazing.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
So that's how I met Brenda. And then she was a great cook. And so that's, we kind of teamed up on that place. And, you know, so in between, took myself out of the scene for a pretty good while. I still played, But I was pretty, I could have and should have kept my foot in the door a little bit better. I was pretty cocky, man. I just said, when I get ready, I'll just go back and everybody will be going, hey, Johnny Nicholas. Well, it doesn't work like that, you know. Ray said they interviewed him for Texas Monthly when they were doing a thing about me. And Ray said, one of the famous country guys told him, he said, yeah, you know, Ray, it's real, real easy to get out of show business, but it's not so easy to get back in.
No.
You know?
Yeah.
And of course, everything's changed so much now with all of the stuff that's happened. It's different, man. But, you know, man, I still do stuff for the same reason I did it back then. So this is really a kind of an anchor for me of where I started.
Yeah.
You know, and the stuff that I really loved, and I still love it. But I listen to it and I go, man, I'd really dig this stuff. And yet it's a piece of my story. I'm already making plans, you know, I've got new songs for my next album. I'm already working. Probably going to start recording sometime next year, probably in the spring. I'll start working on stuff with Scrappy and Chipman and Bruce and, you know, we'll start performing some of the songs, and there's always a few of them that we're doing, but I'm already thinking about that. I want to work this thing right now because it's pretty significant, man. It's a pretty cool record. And
and people should try and get the physical copy. Jamie had texted me and been like, and she was like, man, you need to actually get that. Make sure you get like the album because the packaging is really special, and it's worth it. This is a beautiful booklet. The package is great. Super classy.
Yeah. Well, the Dodds sisters, Sarah and Shauna, did the design work. And
oh, yeah?
Terrific. Backstage. They're the ones that they did. They've won a couple of Grammys for album design.
Did they do like that?
Reckless Kelly.
Reckless Kelly
and
one,
then
yeah,
the
yeah.
Bob Wills, the Asleep at the Wheel, Bob Wills thing, the last one that they did. They won Grammys for both of those, but they were very excited about this, and they're good old friends of mine. And so I was really thrilled to have them, and they did a beautiful job, man. Yeah.
How do you listen to music now?
Well, I've got
you put
my
that stuff on your phone.
I've got an old hi-fi with a handle on it, and you can carry around, and it plays 78s, 45s, and LPs. I mean, I've got that, and I've got a couple old, you know, stereos that I inherited from my aunt and uncle, my mom. I've got, you know, I haven't had access to my vinyl for a while because I had stuff got broken down and I didn't get it fixed. So I listen to, you know, I listen to CDs. And I've learned how to, you know, load stuff onto my little laptop and my iPhone. And so I kind of, you know, if that's what you're asking, how do I? Yeah.
Because you've gone through a transistor radio phase to like shit where you can listen to anything you can think of right now on your phone.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, man, to think about.
It's crazy. Just real quick before we get off this, because I do want to ask this, because I'm 49. So I had records. 45s, 8-tracks, cassettes, CDs, and now MP3s. I don't have that kind of hearing. Like, I'd never be a mastering guy, you know? Like, I'm more of like a, just whatever.
So, yeah, me too.
So my question to you is, can you pick out what sounds better?
Oh, yeah, man.
What's the best sounding
one? But you know what? I can't do it on my stuff.
Right.
I'm the worst person in the world to listen to my stuff, except there's some real obvious things. But, you know, I'll tell you what sounds better. There's nothing like vinyl.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a CD made that if you put it against the same on vinyl that sounds anywhere near as good.
That's the one thing that when it moved over to CDs, there was kind of like a cold.
Yeah, I mean, eight tracks sounded good. Great.
Yeah, Except they cut it off at, like, in the middle of a song.
Except for that, yeah. Scrappy and I were talking about that the other day. It's like, yeah, man, they sounded really great, but then all of a sudden you go, boom.
I can tell you, I can still remember songs when I was a kid that I knew, like, you got to wait for the thing. And then it just pops up in the middle of the song.
Yeah, I know. That's crazy, man.
What an odd thing. So, so you're going to record a new record? You're going to do it with Bruce again?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Those are my
guys.
You guys
record live, right?
No. When we do my next album, like Future Blues, Fresh Air, they were done in the studio. Future Blues was over here at Satellite, little studio that Dave Glasgow had. Fresh Air was recorded at Arlen. We did that live. We recorded live in the studio, we added and did stuff to it.
Yeah, it feels like that. It has a very organic.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really interested. I'd love to do more in the way of recording the way I'd really like to do an old school recording the way they did it back in the day, where you had the right room that sounded right, and you got everybody placed in the right places, and then you found a spot. The engineer or producer would walk around until he found one spot where he could hear all the instruments.
That's where you put the
equally
mic.
And then you put one mic there, and then you had one mic for the vocals.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, man. Yeah. That requires that the musicians are all so dialed in, and that they don't play too loud, and that everyone can hear everyone else, and you know where it's all happening without all of the stuff that happens with monitors and blah blah blah.
Yeah, it requires that musicians be musicians and listen to each other.
Exactly. And there's a lot of times when you see, like last night, man, I was over at the One-to-One, and I went to see Jamie and her band.
Oh, yeah.
They were terrific, really, really tight. They sounded great. And I told her, she asked me this morning, when I was talking to her, she asked me, I said, man, you guys killed it. You sounded great. I said, the only thing was, whoever was doing the sound, and this happens a lot. There are too many effects and reverb and stuff that they added, and it starts, you can't distinguish the instruments as well.
It begins to wash everything together.
It does.
Slowly blurs the sound.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. And so, but that's a real common thing. I mean, there's a lot of people that just, that's how they do stuff. And, you know, I'm getting more and more to the place in my life where I'd really love
to go to the White Horse. There isn't a guy there that's going to throw reverb on you. You just run sound for yourself there, don't you?
Right. Yeah. No. They've got a guy, but he's real cool. And there's it's just pretty straight up. We're playing there tonight.
Yeah.
And I love that place, man. We have a blast over there. That's my little, you know, there's something to be said for playing without monitors, man.
There is something to be said for playing without monitors. I mean, not that I like it, but I know exactly what you mean. They're like some of my most transcendent musical moments have not been on a big stage with everything. It's been like in that front room at the Hole in the Wall where I couldn't hear myself, but I was having I was there.
Yeah.
I was in that place that we've been trying to get to like junkies.
Yeah, right. Exactly, man. That's what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. You surround yourself with other musicians that are like that. All those guys are like that. Danny Levin. As strange as that guy is, he is like a living, breathing musical entity.
Yes, he is.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people. See, I grew up musically and spiritually in a lot of ways down in South Louisiana. And that's kind of I always gravitate back there. I was just there in October for this very organic festival called Black Pop. People go and they camp all week. They have a camp where they do different, all you walk around, there's fiddle guys over here and accordion guys over here, guitar players over here, and the Tex-Maniacs come down, they have, you know, the conjunto. I mean, it's all this cool stuff, and people just kind of go and hang out and listen and learn and little workshops and things. And then at night, and they cook during the day. They have these big black pots and they cook food, and then everybody gets together and they have a community dinner, and then they move the tables and they set up in the old dance hall and they set up a band. They have two bands every night and people dance all night. And then on the weekend, it moves to Lafayette, and they have a big a festival called Black Pot Festival, which is really cool, too. But that's, see, those kinds of scenes, and there's a lot of great players down there, man.
Yeah.
And a lot of young people really playing the old stuff and playing it right. It's encouraging.
Do you find that here much?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, there's some great players here, man. Like, I mean, I was blown away. I mean, I'm watching Jamie and those guys last night, and I'm just like, I'm trying to learn and absorb and learn from people all the time, you know, and I'm like, wow, you know. And
Jamie's a really special artist, man.
She's a special person.
Yeah, special person for and sure. Artist. Special artist, yeah. So is Jane, her roommate.
Yeah, she's amazing. I didn't get to stay for her set last night. I had to get out back. I had to get back.
It's a long drive, man.
It's a long, yeah. By now, it's like...
It's nothing.
It's nothing.
Yeah.
You know, it's autopilot, you know. But yeah, I missed, I really wanted to hear Jane. I have heard her, and I have played with her, too. Her and Jamie came out. We did a brunch thing together. It was really cool. But I have heard her before, so... anyhow, man, that's, yeah, that's what it's all about. And that's why I hope, you know, I mean, I am a traditionalist, man, when it comes down to it. But I also don't feel limited by tradition at all. I feel like it's, you know, that's just your foundation. And there's so many other things. It's all music, you know.
Yeah.
So many other things you can do. And if you sing from your heart, that's the blues anyhow.
Yeah. That's what you've shown us. Johnny Nicholas and Friends, Too Many Bad Habits, comes out on Tuesday. It comes out on Tuesday?
The album is available. It's at Waterloo, but the CD release party is next, a week from today, Thursday.
Right, but this will come out on, this episode will come out, so it'll be the Thursday.
Oh, okay.
So it'll be this Thursday.
This Thursday.
This Thursday, December 7th, an in-store at Waterloo at 5 p.m. And if you want to do the whole day, then you can do the 5 p.m. and then go to Antone's and see Johnny Nicholas and Friends. Are you going to be, Scrappy and all those guys going to be playing?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's going to be great.
Be my band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to come out to that. Who else is playing on that bill? Is there?
I don't think anybody else is on the bill at Antone's. It's just us. It's Johnny Nicholas and Friends. I'm not sure who. I've got some people that might be making appearances that I'm not sure about yet. But, you know, we're mainly going to be doing our thing, we for sure, it'll be the four of us, myself, Scrappy, John, and Bruce at Waterloo, and then at Antone's, and we'll see, there might be some guests popping in.
Okay, that'll be awesome. Your website is johnnynicholasblues.com. People can find you there, find where you're playing. You play a lot around, you play sax, and you play, are you doing Thursdays next month
at the White Horse?
At the White Horse?
That's in that Tiffany Six, my side project.
Okay, that's Tiffany Six.
Yeah,
okay,
I do that about once a month because it's all the guys are doing different things, and, you know, but we really dig getting together to do that. And I'm working on some other little things too. But yeah, Saxon is my main hang. I mean, I'll play at other places too. But in between being on the road and doing stuff, regionally and up and then out to the, I play on the East Coast, New Mexico, you know, South Louisiana.
Yeah.
So, you know, but yeah, I'm around.
Yeah. Go find him at johnnynicholasblues.com. Thanks for doing the show, man. You got to come back on. I think this should be a continuing series.
Oh, I got stories.
I know you do. I know you do. I texted Scrappy yesterday and I was like, hey, I got Johnny coming in tomorrow, and he was like, oh, that's great. And I was like, anything I should know? He's like, great stories. That was it. He wasn't even like, ask him about this. It was just like straight up great stories. Great dude. Thanks, man.
Excellent. Thank you, Johnny.
Johnny Nicholas, reissuing his 1977 album, his very first album, Too Many Bad Habits, Johnny Nicholas and Friends. They are celebrating in Austin, Texas, Thursday, December 7th, with an in-store at Waterloo Records at 5 p.m. and a special release show that night at Antone's, Thursday, December 7th. go to johnnynicholasblues.com and find out all about it. And also pick up his last album, Fresh Air. Amazing record produced by my friend Bruce Hughes and one of Downbeat's best of 2017. Amazing artist, Johnny Nicholas. What great stories. I feel like I got educated. I feel like I might have found my person that might be able to lead me back into the blues and teach me some stuff that I haven't learned along the way. It's a great thing. I might fill in some holes in the education. Get some continuing education with Johnny Nicholas. Great talking to that guy. I hope he comes back soon. Go to johnnynicholasblues.com. His album, Too Many Bad Habits, 40 years ago came out. Now you can get the gorgeous reissue produced by Bruce Hughes and remastered by my good pal, Matt Parmenter, over at Ice Cream Studios. Great dudes, great people all around, Johnny Nicholas. Hey, while you're out there checking out johnnynicholasblues.com and finding stuff out about him, don't forget that you can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, on your iPhone podcast app, on your Android podcast app, on Stitcher, on TuneIn, and basically anywhere where you find podcasts. You will get a new show every Tuesday and every Friday. This Friday, great conversation with a dear old friend of mine, Conrad Keeley from And You Will Know Us from the Trail of Dead, who are currently working on their 10th album. Exciting, right? All right, let's hear some more music from Johnny Nicholas from his album, Too Many Bad Habits. Pick it up. Do it. JohnnyNicholasBlues.com. Have a great week, whatever it is you're doing. Maybe I'll see you out at one of those Johnny Nicholas shows on Thursday. Let's get down.